brought to you by bedroombattlefield.com. This is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. It's Matthew with you here, and we've got loads for you on this episode. We have an audio battle report with myself and Robert, and we have Samsa from 28 Magazine as well, a chat with him to talk about the magazine and the sort of 28 community in general. So we're going to kick things off with the game that Robert and I played. It was a sort of homebrewed version of Song of Blades and Heroes. But first up, I wanted to take a moment to thank this episode's sponsor, Warbases, longtime friend of the show, Warbases. And I have obtained some more of their fine wares because I was having a wee think recently about skirmish games and the identification of particular models. This could be, I mean, let's say for example that you had a warband of like the old Monopose Space Marines, or just a warband where all of the miniatures looked pretty similar to one another. And this is an issue for me when it comes to things like, well, I've been experimenting with using a card-based deck, you know, a turn-based sequence. So you're drawing a deck to see whose turn it is. You need to know which model's which. This is also relevant if you're tracking wounds, or even if you want to give each of your miniatures a name. You know, they're a different character. But if they all look very similar, how do you know who's who? So I started to think to myself, is there such a thing as like a miniature tray for a single miniature? And I had a wee look on Warbase's website, and of course there is. You know, they do all sorts of different movement trays, all sorts of different MDF stuff. And yeah, sure enough, like I say, there's single miniature movement trays. I did ask Diane at Warbase's, like, why do people use these, you know, if not for the purposes that I'm looking for them? And she was saying about people use them in like dioramas and stuff, or big terrain pieces where they want to slot miniatures in. And also, you know, games like The Old World, I talked about that in our last sponsor segment with Warbases, that, you know, when Games Workshop essentially require people to rebase their or resize the bases of miniatures, things like this could come in handy as well. So what I've done, I've got a pile of square ones and a pile of round ones, because I use both bases. You know, I've got a mishmash of different miniatures on squares or rounds. And I ordered up a batch with 5mm diameters on them. So if you could imagine a miniature on a 25mm round base or square base, and this is like, you know, for a round, it's almost like a washer with a base under it. I think you can just get the washer style movement trays for single miniatures, but mine's I've got the wee base under it as well. So the miniature just sits in there, and there's a, like I say, a 5mm diameter. What I'm going to do, I've got paint pens, and I'm just going to add tiny wee numbers to these. So I'll paint them green or black depending on what miniatures I'm using them for, and they'll just, like I say, have a wee number, and that'll correspond to whatever character it is. And yeah, then I can know immediately whose turn it is. I could track wounds if we're playing a game with wounds, or I could even give the characters names and other stats and stuff like that as well. So I'm going to be painting those up in the coming weeks or so. And it prompted me to just spend a bit of time on Warbase's website as well. I was looking at some of the 15mm terrain. Loads of really good value stuff. And their whole website's really good value. But, you know, looking at that 15mm stuff, you could pick quite a lot up for not very much at all. A wee bridge there that caught my eye, actually. I'm in the market for a bridge at 15mm. I also seen on there where Warbases are based. There's a pub local to them called The Red Lion. I've been in there a few times. Really nice wee pub. And they've actually got a 15mm version of that pub. Looks really cool. So I might pick that up at some point in the future as well. Take my miniatures for a bar lunch. So big thanks to Warbases for sponsoring another episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. And please go and check them out. It's bedroombattlefields.com/warbases is the special wee link there that lets them know that you've came via us. And like I say, if you're in the market to identify those little warbands where you've got similar looking miniatures, I could highly recommend getting the single figure movement trays from them as well. All right, Robert, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back.
Yeah, we're going to play a wee game again. So it's set up in front of you here. Do you want me to talk you through the? I mean, you can't see it, but the listener can't, obviously. So
yes, please.
I'll try and do that without standing on my headphone cable. So on the, let's call it the south side, we've got some kind of Viking marauder-y characters down there. You see there's less of them than up at the other end, loads of villagers.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think, oh yeah, this is just your classic, here's a bunch of villagers defending their homes against some marauding Vikings. But it's not really the case with this scenario, because this is a place called Morbid Moor. Do you think that was Bobby's brother, Morbid Moor?
Oh, could be, yeah. He never got into football. He was always a bit gloomy.
So this is the site of the burial site of an undead Chaos Warrior from 1,000 years ago. That's potentially his gravestone in the middle of the middle of the park there, I was going to call it. And the stars have aligned tonight to enable a ritual to summon him. So what's happened here, these villagers, this village is built around, let's call it a shrine, they're actually a bunch of chaos worshipping villagers. Do you remember that wee village in Oblivion where everyone was really weird? There was like tunnels under the ground and that.
You went there and
people were like, oh, I don't know what you're doing here, like, go away. And turned out they were, yeah, it was a bit of a sort of Innsmouth take, I think.
Right, a bit of mischief going on.
Yeah, so this is what we've basically got, this wee village. They're all a bit weird, praying to the dark gods, trying to summon a undead chaos warrior. And you'll see here they've got a wee shaman. He's about 7 or 8 years old, but, you know, that doesn't stop him from doing his magic. He's got a wee captive there. He's going to perform the ritual by probably stabbing him a wee bit, cutting his throat and stuff like that.
Aye. Kneeling down, arms tied behind their back.
Yeah. But these marauders coming down from the north, they're actually escorting this sort of weird tentacled chaos sorcerer as well. He's got his own captive up there. Don't know where they got the captives, but they've got them. So he's going to attempt to perform his own summoning ritual. So they're going to see who could summon this guy first. And then, I suppose, take him into their ranks, use him in other missions and stuff like that. In terms of the rules of the game, it's a kind of homebrewed version of Song and Blades and Heroes, which we've played before. So
right.
We were talking about this the other week. It's the simplest rule set we've ever played. It's the one with the stick-based measurement system.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So really simple rules, but I've kind of adapted it a wee bit because Song of Blades and Heroes, you do the quality roll to see how many turns you're going to get. And if you fail your roll, you could lose your turn and the turns hop back and forward. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah, you have to announce how many turns you want to go for or something.
Yeah.
Right?
Aye, so you could roll 1, 2, or 3. And if you roll just one dice and fail it, you could keep your turn and move to the next guy and so on. But if you rolled 2 dice and lost both those rolls, the turn switches to your opponent.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to do, I wanted to draw from Rangers of Shadowdeep. You know how we like the event cards in Rangers of Shadowdeep?
Yes.
At the end of each turn, it gave it a bit of narrative flavour and other things happened. So I wanted to incorporate that into this game. But of course, if you're doing the quality roll thing, the turns are really unpredictable. You could just be jumping back, turn.
Mm-hmm.
So what I did instead, which I thought worked well in our last game, was do a card deck instead. So we're drawing cards. Each card is associated with a miniature and they'll take their turn. So we don't know who's going to take the first turn and so on. We work through the whole deck. Then we'll draw an event card and then the next turn will start.
Okay, okay.
Does that make sense so far?
Makes sense. I cannot guarantee I'll memorise it, but
it's all right. I'll keep you right. Although that's not a reassuring thing.
Good stuff.
The way the ritual works, the way the summoning ritual works, is at the end of each turn, we'll each roll a d6. And as each turn passes, you're just adding to your score. So you're rolling each turn. And it's the first person to hit 21. A combined roll of 21, which probably takes about 6 turns on average.
Right, okay.
So the first person to roll 21 or more, has successfully completed the ritual, doesn't guarantee that they'll be getting this Chaos Warrior on their side, because we'll then both roll, and the person who completed the ritual will get a +2 to the roll. So it's more likely that they'll get him. But I thought, you know, I like the idea, the unpredictability there, that they've tried to summon him, but he's got up and he's thought, well, I'm not going with you, actually, I'm going with them. So
classic, though, summoning a thing that then turns on you.
Yeah, it's never happened before in fiction or anything like that. So the way the game works, really straightforward. Each miniature, when it's their turn, will get 2 activations each. They're going to move with the shortest stick because we're just playing on a small playing area.
Yeah.
So you could move twice or you could move and fight. All of your, I'm saying all your villagers, you could go the Marauders if you want. I've not decided on who goes who. So all of the villagers, they don't have any modifiers in combat. So combat's just going to be a straight up roll, D6 versus D6. Winner takes all. No wounds. You beat somebody, they're dead. I wanted to try that. Let's not track wounds. Let's not be pushing each other. Let's not be knocking anyone over. Yeah. You're dead.
We might get this done in less than 3 hours.
Yeah. So the villagers, they don't have any modifiers to their combat. And the Marauders, the Vikings, they have a +2, which doesn't sound a lot, but that does make them pretty, you know, likely to come out on top in a combat. But it's not impossible that, you know, some of them will get taken down.
And it's a D6, right? So that's like 33%, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a chunk.
So the Undead Chaos Warrior, Azrath, if he ends up on the table, which I'm sure he will at some point, he's a +3 for whoever controls him. Ooh. So he's pretty formidable. There's the chance that a big dire wolf's going to be on the table as an NPC at some point. That's one of the events.
Oh, aye.
He's a +3. And he's fast as well. Both of the sorcerers, they're +0. So after the ritual, you know, they won't move until the ritual's completed one way or the other. Then they could get involved, but they're not very powerful.
Right.
They might have to. That's the thing. You or I could try and attack the opposition shaman or wizard, whatever you want to call them. And basically, if you kill them, you're going to complete the ritual instead because they can't. Because their wizard's dead. Combat bonus for each friend in base combat, you get a +1 for that. So if I've got 2 guys on one of your guys, I'll get a +1 for every extra friend that I've got, and vice versa. If only one villager is left on the table, I imagine the Chaos Gods take a wee bit of interest and just juice them up a wee bit. So they'll get a +2 if there's just one villager left on the table.
Fair.
Again, keeps it interesting. There's nothing worse than when the result's just a formality.
Aye.
From about turn 3. So if only one Marauder's left on the table, they could be gifted another +1, which would take them to +3 in total. Again, you don't want to make them invincible, because then that's game over, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
As for the winner, it's basically just last man standing, which sounds really boring, but there's loads that obviously will happen to see how that pans out. It's not just a fight to the, it is a fight to the death, but it's a fight to the death with lots of other things going on as well. So hopefully that keeps it more interesting than just let's just fight each other. So do you want to hear, we've got 10 event cards, but 5 of them are basically no event. So that's just where nothing happens.
Right, okay.
I don't think you want to be drawn a new event every single turn. You know, this happens, and then this happens, and then that happens, and like...
And then a tornado.
Yeah, exactly. A shark... What was it? A sharknado?
Yeah.
So, here are the events that could actually happen. The first one is wolf. A massive wolf leaps from the darkness, attacking the next character whose card is drawn. So place them in base contact on the standing stone side. So, basically, you're going into a new turn, and if the wolf's going to appear, it's basically the first miniature whose card gets drawn, they're going to get attacked by a wolf.
Right.
Probably die. Maybe not. After that, the wolf, you know, if the wolf survives, it just becomes an NPC, basically attacking the nearest person to it.
Just going mental.
Yeah. Another event that could happen is called Storm. The dark clouds can hold their weight no longer. A torrential downpour soaks the landscape, reducing visibility and turning the ground into a boot-sucking bog. Reduce activations to one in this turn.
Ooh.
So we've all got two each, but in that turn, if this card was drawn, we'd only get one activation. So it would slow everything. It would bog everything down for a turn.
Yeah.
You'd have to be a bit more tactical, I suppose. Another event which could happen, Laughter of the Dark Gods. The gods are amused by the events unfolding below and watch on with interest. They decide to test someone's faith. Draw the next card and roll a d6. So we've picked up a card that's associated with one of the miniatures on the table. So we roll a d6 for them. On a roll of a 1 to 3, the character is struck dead by lightning. On a roll of a 4 to 6, they are blessed with a combat bonus, which is +2 for villagers and +1 for marauders. So again, a wee bit of roids gets somebody going.
Aye, they didn't muck about, those chaps up above.
The fourth potential event, Blessed Stone. The nearest character to the stone, the big standing stone in the middle, is blessed with a combat bonus, +2 for villagers, +1 for marauders. So you'd think that's a good idea to try and get a couple of characters near the stone.
Because you know it's coming, eh?
Yeah. And then here's the other potential event, Cursed Stone. Any characters, that's characters plural, within a long stick's distance to the stone are blasted back in a straight line. They take no damage or face any further penalty. So everyone just gets...
How far back?
Just to the edge of the table or the nearest building or obstacle.
Oh, hell.
So it doesn't give you any damage, but it upsets your formation a bit, doesn't it? So.
Somewhat, aye.
So that's the events. I think I've covered everything. I did playtest this and it worked. I had to tweak a few things, but
yeah.
Forgive me if we find any kinks or that, we'll just work them out on the fly.
Yeah.
So, all right, who do you want to go? Because I don't care who I go.
I'm happy, just, you know, pragmatic reasons that I'm closest to the what do you call them, Ravagers?
Yeah, the Vikings, marauders. The Marauders, yeah.
Yeah, I'll go with them. Why not?
All right, let's get to it. So, Robert, the last dice has been rolled. That was pretty entertaining until the last, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. A few twists and turns, and all in all, a pretty good wee adventure.
Yeah, and I mean, that was my intention, was that it's never really assured as to who's going to win it until the last roll, and that is what happened. Like, it did... I mean, if we start at the sort of start of the game, I've got the numbers. So first few turns when you play this, it just feels like it's villager, villager, villager. And I was just able to basically stream forward in large numbers. I did get, like, I'd lost 6 or 7 before I managed to take down one of your marauders. It was my drunk guy. He's holding a glass of beer over his head. He obviously just smashed it over the boy's face. But... I took one of your guys down, and you were saying at the time, like, you feel that loss, don't you? Because you had so few guys anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. It was like losing an aircraft carrier, you know?
I mean, I was suddenly right down the other side of the table. It looked like, I mean, I did actually get one of my villagers right up to your shaman. Didn't have enough activations left to try and fight him and prevent him from completing the ritual, but you had kind of been a bit more cautious with keeping guys back anyway, hadn't you? So you were able to come and deal with him.
Yeah, I'd moved my standard bearer up a little bit, but then quickly moved him back when I saw how quickly you were coming in to get in behind me. And that was enough to give me enough of a plus when it came to the fight to stop your chap from stabbing my shaman.
Yeah, I was playing quite an aggressive game, but... I took a lot of casualties because we're not playing wounds. You just lose contact combat and you're dead, which I really like. I like that risk. Like, you know, if you're going to go in for this fight, you better be prepared to die, basically. So,
and that's kind of real, isn't it? If you and I, you know, swung real swords at each other, whoever hits first is the winner, and that's basically it.
Aye, a wee dagger in the gut, and that's you, isn't it? It's not like you're saying, oh, well, that's 8 hit points.
Yeah, I'm down to 70%.
Yeah, so I was taking big casualties, and the game really started to swing in your favour, although one thing that wasn't swinging in your favour was the ritual. because I was rolling really well.
Yeah.
It became quite clear that I was going to complete the ritual first, which I did. Of course, you do still have to roll off against each other, but I had the plus two. I think I rolled a six anyway. So
yeah.
So Azrath, the Chaos Warrior, was summoned to my side. What were some of the events looking back? So we had the weather event, which slowed me down a bit. I mean, it slowed us both down, but given I had the numbers at that stage, it was, I'd say, more detrimental to me.
And we'd already moved up the board or around a fair bit, so it wasn't like, oh, I need to cross half the board and now I can only move one at a time. So it didn't make too much of a difference. It just meant that nobody could move very far and do combat in the same round.
Mm.
But that was fine.
We had the Blessing of the Stone. That was my jester. It was Baffy's the jester. He was standing right next to it. So he got a blessing. He got a plus two as his combat score, which made him then as powerful as any of your characters.
Yeah.
And then two of your boys ganged up on him and killed him. So that was him, wasn't it? He didn't really get to do anything.
Yeah. That was unfortunate. But that, you know, that's the luck of the die. 1 minute you're getting the plus and then it's taken away again. Just like the werewolf who jumped on my guy. And if the werewolf had come out sooner, there would have been a much higher chance he would have attacked one of yours, because you would have had more cards in the deck to choose, like, who's it going to attack. It attacked one of mine, but I battered him.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the wolf pounced on one of your guys, and that was when it started to look like things were maybe turning a wee bit for you. You had lost a couple of guys, and then this wolf's pounced on one of you, but you managed to kill it straight away. Guy was wearing a fur coat.
Pelted it.
But you ended up having the numbers, but I've obviously summoned the Chaos Warrior, who's the most powerful character on the table, because he's got a plus three.
Yeah.
You had kind of retreated your three or four guys back, so I had to come and attack you. You had a few bonuses because of your numbers, but I rolled really well, and before you know it, I'd thinned a couple of them out, hadn't I?
Yeah, yeah. Your Chaos Warrior won every fight, and every time he did, I lost not only an attack or two, you know, two activations per chat, but also the bonuses of having extra numbers. And then very quickly, it went from being in my favour to yours, and that's the game.
And of course, one of the events was the Laughter of the Gods, which was, you know, the next character to get drawn from the deck. On a roll of a 1-3, the gods strike him down with lightning, or on a roll of 4-6, he gets a boost for the rest of the game. And it was your leader, Old Whitehair.
Yeah.
He got hit by lightning, didn't he? He rolled a 3, so...
That was it. Yeah, and me losing one of my guys is more significant than you losing one of your many villagers. So that was unlucky for me to... again, like, if that card had been drawn from the events deck sooner, it would have been more likely to be you that had to roll 1-6. But it was me, and I rolled a 3, and that was it. Big chunk of my army gone in one unholy swoop from above.
Yeah, we were saying there's a possibility, obviously, with this game, that you could summon the Chaos Warrior and he could immediately be struck down by the gods again, couldn't he? Like, that could happen.
Oh, yeah.
Depending on how the cards came out. So, the last character that you had on the table was your wizard, your sorcerer.
Yeah,
but he wasn't very powerful anyway. He had to fight Azrath and he got paggered, so...
Yeah, unmodified attack against plus three wasn't looking good for him at that point. So, yeah, no, I think I did all right. Kind of played a bit strategically, and that worked so far, but you can't really account for, you know, high rolls that go against you.
So what did you think overall? Did you enjoy it? I thought it went in really quickly.
Yeah, no, it was good. I really liked the fast pace of it. Not that I mind other games where it does take a bit more time because you've got more time to think, but it was a nice change of pace, quite literally.
Do you think there is room for more actual events in that event deck? Like I did say at the start, I didn't want to pack it full of events. So like we're saying, the Sharknado comes over at one point, then there's an earthquake, then, you know, somebody gets hit by lightning. But we did have a few, because I mean, half the event deck are no events.
Yeah.
So there's maybe room for, you could have that Laughter of the Gods maybe just one more time in there. So
yeah.
It happens twice or...
Or you could even have it that any event could happen at any time. and you just make it like a random roll to see which event actually happens, you know, mm-hmm. maybe something mm-hmm. like that.
Suddenly you've got 9 wolves on the table.
Yeah, possibly, yeah. Or maybe it could only happen twice in total, but it could happen twice, something like that.
A hosepipe ban, because yeah. there's been a drought.
And suddenly everybody's like got 3 activations because they can move around on the firm soil a lot more.
Yeah. But I know I like that. I've been toying with the scenario for a while. Obviously, it is in its essence, mechanically, it's Song of Blades and Heroes. But
yeah,
and I don't mind the quality thing. I think that's a good mechanic. But like I say, I needed a way for us to have defined turns so we could bring in the event cards. And I do like the random drawing of, like, you just don't know who's going next. It makes things a bit less gamey because you can't kind of manage in advance. Oh, well, you know, I've got X turns to get these guys here and I know exactly how this will pan out. It's a bit more chaotic than that, which...
I like that. And also the fact that, like, oh, have I moved this guy yet? Have I moved that guy yet? Mm. And having to keep track of it. It means there's less admin involved because it's one card. Right, who's that? It's him. And it's a lot easier to manage, basically.
Yeah. So I'm thinking of taking that system and for our next game going back to the sci-fi genre. So we'll get some...
Laser guns.
Yeah, laser guns, androids, all that stuff.
Nice.
And what I'm thinking is, obviously the characters here, all they've got is their combat score. So the option is you just keep that, you know, we've got one combat score and that's that. Or you bring in that they've got an attack score and a defense score because, you know, they're defending against being shot at versus shooting.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Sorry, what were you going to say?
I was just thinking, I had a thought there. I don't know if you remember Space Crusade, Hero Quest in space, and especially the video game. I never actually played the board game, but different troopers had different weapon abilities. Like one would be able to shoot and damage anything in a straight line. So if there were 3 guys lined up, you could take them all out. Or one would have more like a rocket launcher and it would be an area of effect. And if you've got one of those little gaming circles, you could say, right, splash damage all in that area there, things like that. There's a lot of different things that you could introduce like that.
So here's what I'm thinking, an early idea that I've got. Pass the sticks over, please. So Song of Blades and Heroes, you've got 3 different sticks. 3 different length sticks. So let's imagine that this is a table of sci-fi miniatures. He's got a gun there, and this is his target. So what I'm thinking is, like we did before, nothing's off limits on the mat. As long as you could see somebody, you could shoot at them. But if we take the long stick, okay, so I'm out of range as it pertains to the long stick. So maybe at this point, I'm a -1 modifier. Yeah. And then maybe if I was within range of the longer stick, it could be unmodified. And then maybe if you're within range of the medium stick, maybe you get a +1. And then if you're basically got the gun at his head, you get a +2. So you could bring that in. So
yeah,
you've got an advantage for getting up close, but also that's risky as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, so, I mean, again, you know, everything's got its place. But see, when you've got a game where it's like, whether I'm shooting you from this corner to that corner or whether I'm shooting you from there to there, it's the same role. Again, yeah. I never like the term realistic in tabletop gaming, but surely the shot straight across an entire battlefield, surely that needs to be more difficult.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, there are turn-based games, even video games like XCOM, if you ever played that, or it was known as UFO. Depending on how far away you were, you'd have a smaller percentage to hit and so on. And snipers would have a much better chance of hitting from a further away distance and even a penalty if you're too close, that kind of thing. So, yeah, I'd definitely be up for that.
Yeah, I'd much rather that. And it gets it done in one roll than the old... Again, it has its place, but roll to hit, roll to wound, you know, roll to save. You could end up with 3 or 4 rolls just to determine an outcome.
Yeah.
Whereas you could instead just take the player's locations and let's just get that into one roll and see what happens straight away. But there's still, you know, there's penalties involved. So
yeah,
I'm not
definitely
a games designer, but stuff like that, because my brain is quite simple, just the less amount of different roles and things I've got to keep track of, the better. So
yeah, there's always got to be that balance between realism and how you manage that realism, which inevitably means more admin and so on. You need it to be fun, you know. It's like, you know, when we were at school playing football, we never really played the offside rule because, do you know what, sod that. It's too much work. Let's just get on with it.
Well, that's that. It was really enjoyable. Like I say, I've got in mind to do a similar thing, but incorporate it back into the sci-fi sandbox as well. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, that'd be great. And, you know, I was just thinking that took an hour and a half at most, and some games take 2 to 3 hours. So that's a consideration if people want a game that they can do.
Aye, it's fast paced, isn't it? I mean, yeah. It does. Like I said to you at the start of this game, like, you know, you have to be a wee bit patient because you had the less characters. So I'm constantly drawing, oh, it's another one of my guys.
Yeah.
But it quickly thins out. Like I said at the start, it's a bit like trading pawns in chess at the start. You know, you're quickly losing a few people. That deck gets thinned out quite quickly. The game does start to really speed up. So
and you can imagine as well, if there was more admin involved in it, and you're doing 4 turns in a row, and I'm sitting in the corner gathering dust because I'm, you know, got nothing to do for 20 minutes, then that could be tiresome for some people and they might lose interest, whereas I barely had to wait more than a minute or two because of the pace of the game. So that's another plus for it.
Yeah, there's no point where one of the players is not engaged, because even if I attack you, you could kill me. Like, it's not like you're just defending against me, so.
Yeah.
Okay, if you want to see pictures of this episode's game, go to bedroombattlefields.com. In fact, go to bedroombattlefields.com/photos. That'll take you directly to, I run a Flickr account with all the photos. So that'll let you see just all the photos that I take of all my miniatures, all my games. So you could see them there directly at bedroombattlefields.com/photos. But if you check the episode show notes, you'll get a link to the, you know, the report itself, where I have written down the kind of homebrew rules that we were using and some of those event cards as well. So if you wanted to do this scenario yourself or something similar, you'll find them in the post link to in the show notes or by going to bedroombattlefields.com. Our question of the month for April 2024 is, have you ever tried to convince a 40k or Age of Sigmar player to play a non-GW miniatures game? If so, what was the response? What game did you play? And crucially, did they enjoy it? I'd love to hear about your own experiences on this front, and you could record your audio feedback by going to bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. That's bedroombattlefields.com/voicemail. And now, back to the show. Okay then, part two of the episode. Now it's time for our chat with Samsa from 28 Magazine. I don't know if you've come across 28 Magazine before, but it's a really spectacular looking publication, you know, really eye-catching, really distinctive, and there's a wider community around it as well, so I wanted to get someone on from 28. I've been wanting to do this for a wee while, so big thanks to Samsa for stepping up and doing so and having this conversation. I kicked things off just by, you know, asking them about that, you know, 28 is a magazine, but you know, what else is it? Is it a community, an aesthetic? Is it a movement even? So I put that question to Samsa, and here's what he said.
It's kind of maybe all of those. Mostly, when I say 28, I usually mean the magazine, but also we have this sort of a collective that encompasses all of us who work on the magazine, and all our other publications are miniatures line and stuff like that. But you can also talk about 28 as being an aesthetic. It kind of is connected to things like Blanchitsu or Ink 28 and stuff like that. They all share this sort of a, yeah, well, yeah, an aesthetic. That's as good a word as any. And I don't know if we can talk about sort of a movement as such. We're not like that cohesive. There's more of a community that's interested in what we do or what we're interested in. And I mean, when I say we, I mean like we who do 28. the magazine and stuff like that.
So throughout this conversation, straight up front, you'll have to excuse what might be perceived as ignorance. It's more just curiosity. I am very new to all this, so I'll maybe ask some stupid questions. You know, you'll maybe mention
please do.
A term that everyone's familiar with and I'm not. So, you know, I often have my head in the sand with a lot of things. So I'm hoping to just sort of dig into it a wee bit more. And I guess, like, I'm trying to think about how I kind of encountered, I think it was either the magazine or the podcast initially. I think it was the podcast, okay? In fact, I'm certain of that now.
32, you mean?
Yeah, and why that was because I found an episode with, is it Nick that does Planet 28, the game?
Yeah, Nick Evans, yeah.
Yeah, so I got Planet 28. Because of our earlier conversation on this podcast with Richard, one of our guests, and he introduced me to that game. And so I must have been looking for more content on that game, and I come across the podcast and the magazine, etc. And, you know, I've really enjoyed all the content that's went out on there, and I'm just starting to dip my toe into the rest of it now. So Planet 28, so you get games with the number 28 in them. Is that, again, first stupid question of the podcast, is that because it's 28 scale, or is there another reason for that?
I think there's many reasons. And trust me, there are no stupid questions. If I just go on, please, you know, stop me and ask clarifying questions. Because usually when I talk about this, I talk about with people who know the lingo, so to speak. So I kind of forget that most people might not actually know what I'm talking about. So 28, I originally came from Ink 28, which is just the old Inquisitor game from Games Workshop, but played in 28mm figures, or with 28mm figures. And it kind of like started as a joke from there. So we have like Planet 28 and blacking out what else we had.
There's a turnip one, isn't there?
Yeah, Turnip 28, yeah, that too. So it kind of like started with the Ink 28, and that kind of like escalated into the joke, and then kind of Alex iterated the 32 podcast from that to like keep up with the joke and stuff like that. I think it was Alex. Well, anyways, one of the guys. So yeah, but it does come from, at the same time, from the 28mm miniatures, but also the Ink 28 thing.
Right, because if I'm remembering correctly, the Inquisitor, that was Gav Thorpe's game, and it was played at, was it 50-something?
54mm, yeah.
Yeah, so there was a 28mm version of that, and then that potentially a catalyst then for the rest of the stuff that's come about.
Yeah, so, well, sort of, I think the original catalyst for this whole thing was the Inquisitor game. And especially like the rule book and kind of what the whole Inquisitor thing represented. Because for the first time, we really went into the nitty gritty human side of the 40K universe. And that combined with the Eisenhorn trilogy kind of like catalyzed a lot of people into getting into this little sort of warband building and studying more of the human side of like the 40K, and from there it just like escalated into everything else, and that's how like the aesthetic started.
When are we talking then? Like, if there's a sort of timeline here, you know, when is this sort of originating?
I think the whole aesthetic started when Dukka Dukka was a thing, way back when. So about 2009, stuff like that. No, actually 2008, because that's when Mick started his Jade Vessel thing. But yeah, it kind of, the origins go back like about 15 years or something like that, and it kind of like grew from there, and it stayed as a sort of like a niche thing for a very long time. But then gradually people like get into it more, especially when we had like more skirmish games come out, or maybe not more, let's say re-released and stuff like that. And people kind of like started doing their own thing and not just like going with what Games Workshop tells them to do. Because that's like the whole point. There's like, you should do you, not what, you know, GW says.
Yeah, I mean, just as someone completely new to all of this, I mean, what it looks like to me is I see a lot of people getting into doing really cool conversions, really cool art styles, you know, messing around with rules, playing around with rules, really getting into, like you're saying, the nitty-gritty of stuff, going down to a real character level. Am I kind of on the right track then?
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like it's exploring, being creative, and like having fun. It's not about doing things in a certain way because someone says so, because it has to be like that. It's not about competitiveness. Well, I suppose some people can be competitive, but it's more about the artistry and the story rather than like doing things in a certain way because you have to do things in a certain way and competitiveness. That's I think that's like the delineating point.
How would you describe the magazine to someone who's never looked at it before?
So it's a digital magazine that focuses on unique and personal projects in the miniatures hobby. We also like to feature art, especially pertaining to the, you know, the aesthetics. The message is sort of we aim to expand the hobby and promote diversity and inclusion through the creativity and freedom of expressions of the people we feature on our like publications, including of course the podcast too.
Yeah, no, the magazine, you know, from what I've seen, the bits and pieces, it's got a very striking visual style, like you're saying, the art. There's a real like look and feel about it, isn't there?
We're all volunteers, but like we take it seriously, and it's like we really finesse it before we release any new volumes, and we try to keep up the consistency so it really does look professional. So we really pride ourselves on that.
So I want to kind of get into, you know, how you came on board with the magazine, with the project, but I guess a good place to start here is to talk us through how you actually got into the hobby in the first place.
Well, all in all, I first started back during 40K's third edition, when we had the, you know, the John Blanche artwork starter box and stuff like that. And then it kind of like, I started collecting armies, but, you know, I never finished one. And it kind of just like, I think like most people, I kind of like wandered off. And then years later, I sort of came back. And that's when I like found Dakka Dakka and all the guys who did Ink 28 there. And it kind of like, I found my own thing, because I really don't have the, I have this kind of a hobby ADHD, you know, so I can't really stick with a project for too long. So I need to make my things usually small. I'm trying to get over that. But, you know, so that kind of like pulled me in. And then I've been kind of on and off every now and again. And now that I've finally, because I usually do miniatures in like, I'll call them seasons. And then I move on to something else, like video games and stuff like that. So my progress as like a miniature painter and, I don't know, so I suppose an artist or something, it's been kind of slow. But then when I like got better eventually, that kind of like brought this fire to be like in the heart of the whole hobby and stuff like that. And from there, well, you were going to ask about how I came into the magazine. I actually kind of like started reading it. I thought it was cool. And I hopped on the Discord. And at some point, Alex Winberg, who's like a creative director, asked if there are any volunteers for like doing some little assistant editing work and stuff like that. So I hopped on this Team 14. And from there, I just like joined the main team just some time ago.
Just sort of swinging back around to your sort of own hobby ventures, like do you play a lot of games currently or at all?
No, actually, I am I'm mostly interested in the converting and painting of miniatures. I don't hate gaming or anything like that. I just, well, mostly it's about I don't really have that many friends, and our timetables never like kind of align. And the other thing is I rarely finish a project, so I don't really have anything to game with. And, you know, playing with bare plastic and metal is, it's not that fun. It kind of, especially, you know, with our aesthetic, it's about the presentation. That's really key to the whole thing. So if you start gaming with bare metal and, you know, you can see all the putty and stuff like that, it kind of like breaks the immersion. So I don't really game that much. I mostly focus on painting and converting.
What are some of the conversion projects that you've worked on recently then, or are working on at the moment?
Actually, my current project is kind of a maybe a surprising one, since I usually don't do big projects. I'm working on a 5,000-point Dogs of War army for 6th edition. So it's kind of a, it's a far-fetched thing for me to like do something that big, but it's been going okay. And I usually do some little smaller projects on the side. Let's see, what do I have here? Well, there's mostly, I have a few single miniatures I've been painting. Now, I'm more focused on painting at the moment than like converting or anything like that. I'm really trying to like find my own style of painting, trying new things, and trying to find something that I like and it feels like me.
How would you describe your painting style then?
Chaotic. No, that's not actually all true. It's experimental, but for the most part, pretty neat. I don't know if that makes sense, but like I try a lot of things. You know, many artists, miniature artists have like their own body of work that really shows their like handiwork. You can see the artist in them. I don't like, my body of work at the moment is trying a lot of different stuff to see what I like and what I can like use in the future to like create my own very specific style.
Is there a painting style or a recurring thread that you see throughout the sort of 28 movement, you know, when you see somebody's miniatures, do you immediately identify them as coming from that sort of 28 space, if you like? Or is there so much variety that it's really impossible to nail it down like that?
I think there are some key things that usually like point to a fascination with the 28 aesthetic, and that's shying away from the GW style of like really bright highlights and exaggerated lights and stuff like that. The 28 style is usually, okay, I hate saying the 28 style like this one, but like the 28 aesthetic usually favors like more down to earth sort of painting styles that kind of imitate realism. There's a lot of painterly styles with the, like, I'll call them the bigger names, like Christoph Kehl, and I'm not sure, I hope I didn't butcher his name right now, but like, yeah, Christoph Kehl and like Miggs and Kari Herzen and guys like that, they have a very, like, sort of specific kind of like painterly style to their miniatures. That kind of thing is, in my opinion, frequent. And then on the other hand, we have a lot of people who kind of gravitate towards the heavy use of like grime and mud effects and stuff like that. And maybe they're going to this sort of a John Blanche style of like representation, which I think it's a bit maybe a misunderstanding of what John does. But yeah.
What miniatures do you prefer to buy and use, if you've got any preference? You know, what companies, what eras?
I mostly focus on Games Workshop products, because a lot of what I have already is GW, and it's really hard to find
other, you know, producers where the scale matches. Because I'm really careful about the that when I do a conversion or a kit bash, everything kind of like meshes together. There's sort of a, they share the, or at least they're close enough in scale and in aesthetics that you can like mix and match. And that's really hard to find in other producers. So mostly I buy Games Workshop minis, either on eBay or from a branded local store or something like that.
And do those then, if you're using eBay, I take it those tend to be older miniatures then, rather than the stuff you could get out the shop right now.
Yeah. I basically hoard old miniatures. I have a lot of old Hammer stuff, for instance, and all sorts of like out of production miniatures, just waiting to find the right time, you know.
Going back to the magazine, then talk us through a typical edition of the magazine and some of the content that we might find in there.
Well, you'll find a lot of things. First and foremost is, of course, the artist focus articles. Those are usually a small like blurb from the artist that we're featuring. We have like a dozen of those in any given magazine. And like maybe what they think are the best pictures, or usually they send us a bunch and we pick a few of those that we think really represent the artist. We have a lot of like event reports. We have some tutorials from various of our own artists or people we know. And we have essays occasionally. Some we've had a couple of challenges too, or like competitions. Oh, and yeah, and we have this hazmat section that like features just like images people have sent us. And we like pick the best ones from there.
How are the contributions sourced then? Is the sort of lead team approaching people and asking them to get involved and submit things, or is there recurring contributors involved? Like, how does that work?
Well, actually, we have a few like regular people who, you know, write for us. We have our staff writers, and then we have like regular contributors, and we also have basically we have an open submission email. Anyone can send stuff there if they want. And maybe we'll take someone in from there or maybe not. And occasionally we do source contributors too. So it's kind of a mix and match. But basically anyone can send us a submission. And if it's something we see fits into the magazine, maybe not like the next, or maybe we'll use it later and stuff like that. But basically anyone can send anything.
Where's the best place for the listener to go then to find the magazine? Is there a domain that we could go to?
Yeah, it's 28-mag.com. You can find anything there. We have all our publications there. We have links to our stores. We do merchandise. We have our own miniatures. And then we also host a number of games on our site, including Planet 28. We have stuff like The Wield, Tonks, which was surprisingly like popular, and a lot of like small indie games.
Big thanks to Samsa there, and I'll put links to 28 in the episode show notes as well. So that's just about it for this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Like I said earlier on, if you're wanting a look at the pictures of the game that Robert and I played, or just the pictures of the miniatures that I've been painting in general recently, head on over to bedroombattlefields.com/photos, and that'll take you to the old Flickr account where you could see them all in glorious Technicolor. I don't even know what that really means, so I'm just saying it. Anyway, thank you very much for listening, as always. And we'll catch up again on the next one.